I see faces that I've seen before, people who attend here regularly, but I also see on each occasion new faces. And that reminds me that I owe it to the Institute to say something about its finances. We have the usual Saturday evening appeal. The Institute, of course, lives by from hand to mouth, I think is the saying goes, and sometimes it doesn't really have enough to live on very well. So we have to keep urging people to support us. I could, I suppose, ask someone like Dr. Shrum to pass the hat at each meeting and make ends meet that way. But we do try another method. We sell memberships and encourage donations. And as you come in, you will see there are pamphlets outside, and each one of those pamphlets has a membership form. And I would urge you to bear the plight of the Institute in mind and to at least become a member. Our speaker this evening is Dr. Daniel Birch, who's Dean of Education at this university. It's always a pleasure to welcome and to introduce one of our colleagues to you. And this evening, I'm very happy to do so. I assume, since he's one of us, that we all know him, and I don't have to spend much time going into great detail. The bare facts are that Dean Birch was born in British Columbia and educated here right through to the University of British Columbia, where he took his Bachelor of Arts and Master of Arts degrees. He then became a teacher in British Columbia in the Maple Ridge School District, and after a short time became the vice principal of a secondary school in that district. He then decided to go off to Berkeley, California, to do his doctoral work. In that work, he, I think, was influenced by an early experience in his life. His parents were missionaries, and they took him to China at the age of one, and he lived there till he was the age of eight. And apart from learning how to speak Chinese, he acquired a profound interest in the Asiatic cultures. It's left him with a concern for the gap in understanding the Asian cultures, and he, in his graduate work and thereafter, has devoted quite a lot of his attention to that, to the problems in that field. He's written books on Gandhi and Asia and life in China. After his graduate work in the United States, he came back to Canada, and he went then to Simon Fraser University, where in 1972 he was appointed Dean of Education. And then he went on in 1975 to become the Associate Vice President Academic. He, in 1981, he struck out on the trail to UBC and came here as the Dean. That's a trail that others have seen fit to take in recent times. So here he is then at UBC, the Dean of Education. And I think there's probably no one who is better qualified to speak authoritatively on the subject he has chosen this evening, which is teaching in Babel, the Vancouver school system. I'll now call on Dean Birch to speak to us.
Thank you very much, Professor Bourne. I appreciate the kind introduction. The topic of tonight's address was suggested by Mrs. Nimitz. as we talked one evening about the tremendous demands linguistic and cultural diversity place on educational institutions, particularly elementary and secondary schools. I was told that I should not assume that everyone was familiar with biblical allusions, and while I didn't expect this evening to stand up and tell a Bible story, nevertheless, let me remind you that the Tower of Babel was that incident told so well in the book of Genesis, in which mankind decided that they would reach to the very gate of heaven and instead were plunged into confusion of languages. In fact, I want to emphasize that in that scriptural story of the Tower of Babel, we find both good and evil, vision and confusion. Babel itself is a play on words, meaning both gateway to heaven and confusion of tongues. And it's to that dichotomy that I'll return later this evening, noting that the same circumstances carry the potential for enlarging our vision and winning the heights, or wandering lost in the plains amidst a confusion of tongues. Not only languages, but confusion arising from the often conflicting demands of policymakers in government, the public, special interest groups, and our clients, students and their parents. Now, when Mrs. Nemitz first called me, she suggested I contrast Japanese education with education in British Columbia. And from the way she spoke, it was clear which system was expected to come out ahead. I noted that we do have some interesting data coming in from such sources as the International Educational Assessment to suggest that educational achievement in our province compares quite favorably to that in many jurisdictions. For example, in a recent mathematics learning assessment, it was interesting to find that grade 8 students in British Columbia achieved at least as well as Ontario grade 8 students, very much better than grade 8 students in the United States, and what was perhaps more surprising to many British Columbians, better than students in Britain, New Zealand, Australia, indeed all the rest of the English-speaking world. They still didn't compare terribly favorably with students in Japan, I'm afraid to say, but there we are. I do have, as Professor Bourne noted, a long-standing personal interest in Asian cultures, but I don't know very much about the Japanese high school. I did, however, learn of a 16-year-old Japanese girl who came to the United States and was, on her first week in the United States, placed in a grade 11 class, where the social studies teacher said to the class, "Give me liberty or give me death." Who said that? It fell on deaf ears, absolute silence. And the teacher repeated a little more agitatedly, or animatedly at least, "Give me liberty or give me death. Who said that?" Dead silence. The third time he repeated it, and the Japanese girl put up her hand, and the teacher said, "Yes, Midori?" "Patrick Henry, Boston, Massachusetts, 1776, she said. Well, this was almost more than the teacher could take, so he berated the class. He said, "You're Americans. You grew up here. You had national history in grade 5. You had it again in grade 8. You had it in grade 11. And it takes somebody on her first week here from Japan to tell you about a national hero?" A deep voice in the back of the room said, "Down with the Japanese." "Who said that?" The Japanese girl said, "Lee Iacocca, Detroit, Michigan, 1982. So much for Japanese and North American education. Now back to teaching in Babel, Vancouver Schools, 1984. I accepted this topic so I could use cultural and linguistic diversity as a springboard for calling attention to the fact that schools and teachers in British Columbia are doing a remarkably fine job under conditions which are very challenging indeed. There was a time, indeed that time spans most of our history as a nation, when Canadians shared a remarkable degree of consensus about the moral and intellectual purpose of the school. In the last two decades, that consensus has fragmented. One element in its fragmentation is the multiplication of people's expectations about what schools should achieve. In part, that multiplication of expectations arises from the increasing diversity of the school population and of our population at large. I intend, therefore, to address three points. Now, you see, that's a cultural revelation in itself. It's my Anglo-Saxon Trinitarian background getting the better of me. But the three points I want to address, or I suppose it could be Latin, after all, Gaul was divided into three parts, wasn't it? My three points are these: the consensus that was, the diversity that is, and one vision of what might be. Let me first address the consensus that was. From colonial days until very recent times, Canada, and indeed its forerunner colonies, reflected a high degree of consensus about the moral and intellectual purpose of schools. In illustrating this, I owe much to Professor George Tompkins and his research on the history of Canadian curriculum. Tompkins has noted that in 1727, the citizens of Montreal addressed a petition to the King of France for the support of teachers and schools that would inspire the young with those sentiments of submission necessary to render them good servants of the king and at the same time good servants of God. And in the very same year, the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel, in establishing its first school at Annapolis Royal, provided teachers imbued with, quotes, a regard for British institutions and with doctrinal soundness, i.e., in accord with the expectations of the Church of England. In the middle of the 19th century, upper Canadian citizens, mindful of the idle and miserable habits of children, were keen to establish a curriculum that would make upper Canada the brightest gem in the crown of Her Britannic Majesty, at least in part by ensuring that their children manifest the first principles of Christian morals essential to every honest man and good citizen. Explicit in Canadian society, though not unique to it, was a concern that the education of the young be grounded firmly in Christian morality and loyalty to the institutions of the empire. Professor Tompkins has often commented on the contrast between Canada and the United States and pointed out that the core traditions in our society are such that it is not accidental that the foundation documents of the two countries have the one committed to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the other to peace, order, and good government. And it is, I think, rather like, rather as Northrop Frye, our distinguished literary critic and national commentator, has noted, that within Canadian society there is a chain of command built into the country from the beginning, the respect for authority. Whether we find it in the Catholic Church and its institutions in New France, in the Hudson's Bay Company and its administration of vast territories, or in the other institutions which have followed, whether expressed in terms of Anglophone Calvinism or Francophone Catholicism, our forebears made clear their commitment to educational purpose in moral terms, strangely foreign to the ears of today's listener. Alison Prentice, in her book, The School Promoters, Education and Social Class in Mid-19th Century Upper Canada, provides insight into the development of a public educational system which became the model for much of Anglophone Canada, especially the West. She quotes Egerton Ryerson, the architect of that system. "I've often revolved in my mind the theories of those political economists who maintain that the essential well-being of man consists in health of body, sufficiency of food, and personal liberty, and who propose to remedy the existing ills of society and bring about the universal reign of millennial happiness by altered forms of government, improved balances of power, other distributions of property, new constitutions and laws of the latest invention, from the exhaustless manufactory of human ingenuity and speculation. I've also endeavored to examine the dogmas of those professed philosophers who, independent of any divine agency and leaving Christianity altogether out of the question, are about to create all things new by the magic power of science and education. In both these plausible and too widely spread theories, there appears to me to be this radical defect, an irrational as well as anti-scriptural omission. Man as a moral being is entirely overlooked." For Ryerson, theology was central to the college curriculum and indeed gave meaning to all other subjects. Indeed, he gave it a place in the college curriculum that I think is much like that which Marxist doctrine would have in communist societies today. Central and the kind of doctrine that informed not only what it was permissible to learn and study, but the framework within which it must be studied. Ryerson's view of the school's social mission was expressed in his vision as follows. The children of, quotes, the rich and the poor meeting together, and under the protection and blessing of God, the maker of them all, imbibing the first elements of knowledge at the same fountain, commencing the race of life upon equal terms, and cultivating feelings of mutual respect and sympathy, which, while they in no respect intrude upon the providential arrangement of order and rank in society, divest poverty of its meanness and its hatreds, and wealth of its arrogance and selfishness. Prentice notes that the orders and ranks of society were not to be disturbed. These were providential. What free schooling was to change were the attitudes of the classes to each other. The poor would lose their envy and the rich their exclusiveness. Tompkins notes that textbook and examination policies proved to be the most effective mechanisms of curriculum control. The core curriculum, in effect, was the reader. And the reader was a wonderfully wide-ranging text that included selections from literature, science, history, biblical and classical studies, and mythology. Its contents emphasized godliness, obedience, frugality, hard work, patriotism and respect for authority, and social order. As the world of formal discourse, readers reinforced the morality taught in the world of conversation of the home, church, and community, while introducing children to a wider cultural heritage beyond those institutions. While portraying the triumph of moral integrity, readers did not flinch from also portraying the harsh realities of life, such as tragedy, crime, drunkenness, and death. In this respect, you have to ask which is the more fantasy-ridden, the reader of that day with its built-in emphasis of particular virtues, or the sanitized middle-class world portrayed in modern readers in the schools today. At the same time, of course, in the mid-19th century, fictitious reading was condemned as a worse dissipation than alcohol and as conducive to vice and crime. By 1900, a process was well underway, which continued through the early decades of this century, as the explosion of knowledge and the wave of new criticism transformed the theological basis of education into a social gospel, emphasizing good works more than spiritual salvation. Nevertheless, Judeo-Christian morality remained the unquestioned goal of education and the means of ensuring that the intellectual mission of the school was directed toward a moral end. As late as 1920, J.H. Putnam, of Putnam and Reed fame in British Columbia, characterized education as a largely spiritual process. Harold Van Brummelen has, in a very recent paper, shown that textbooks other than readers used in Ontario and British Columbia between 1872 and 1925 explicitly, although often indirectly, promoted the moral virtues so important in the school's mission. An 1872 chemistry text, for example, bore witness to the fact that, quotes, man owes everything to God who governs all things. Needless to say, 50 years later, morality was still important, formal religion less so. Professor Tompkins notes that the same period saw the emergence of many new subjects, including agriculture, temperance education, manual training, and domestic science. Not only were these to provide an application and enrichment to the basic school subjects, but they were also intended to serve a variety of moral, intellectual, and cultural purposes, ranging from Canadianizing immigrants and improving their morals to regenerating a countryside. Notice the theological language, regenerating a countryside supposedly threatened with decay in a period when Canada was urbanizing and the city was viewed as an evil place. Professor Sutherland has, in his recent research, noted the continuation, in some sense, through the early part of this century and indeed in the three decades following 1920. In his research on the elementary school, he's noted that the physical environment was drab and unhealthy. By modern standards, the dress of pupils and teachers alike was drab. School routines within and without the classroom were strictly regimented and minutely regulated by systems of buzzers, bells, and often terrifying verbal commands. Such a mode of discipline, together with the curriculum and teaching methods, resulted in a simple mode of rote learning based on the times tables, spelling lists, the Lady of the Lake, capes and bays, geography, kings and queens in history. Now, that isn't all too foreign to much of our recollection, is it? I wouldn't be at all surprised if I were to start, "The stag at eve had drunk his fill, where danced the moon on Monan's rill." I see for Chancellor Klein going right along with me. And I'll bet he could also do the kings of England, William, Henry, Stephen, Henry, Richard, John. Teaching methods were remarkably consistent from teacher to teacher and subject to subject, and as suggested, were rigidly formal. In fact, Professor Sutherland entitles his paper "The Triumph of Formalism." They entailed endless copying of blackboard notes, often in the form of textbook summaries, and rapt attention to teacher lectures and demonstrations. Pupils with hands on their desks were expected to sit up straight and face the front while chanting drills and reading aloud in sequence from the textbook. That's the education that we have tended to romanticize when we recall it. That's the golden age to which we look back. And I think one of the advantages of the kind of research that people like Tompkins and Sutherland are doing is that it reminds us just how mixed was the gold of that golden age. David Tyack of Stanford University has observed that changes in the conception of the North American school were reflected in its architecture. He suggests that it is no accident that the 19th century schoolhouse resembled a church. The early 20th century schoolhouse looked rather like a factory, and today's schoolhouse resembles nothing more than a shopping center, which an image that reflects a myriad of choices tempting or confusing the consumer. Which brings me to my second point, the diversity that is. When in 1953 Hilda Neatby entitled her little book, "So Little for the Mind," she could not be faulted for making that assessment of Canadian high schools. What Professor Sutherland has shown so nicely is that she could, however, be faulted on two counts. She blamed that condition on the Canadian teachers having picked up American theory, and particularly the followers of Dewey, and in their progressivism having undermined the intellectual content of the school. Well, Professor Sutherland points out that the condition of Canadian schools was a strictly made-in-Canada product, and that there was, in fact, neither a tremendous influence of progressivism nor a pre-Deweyan golden age to look back to. But Neatby was in the vanguard of what was to become in North America two decades of school criticism on a scale quite without precedent. October 4th, 1957, saw Sputnik thrown into orbit and North American education plunged into shock. One historian later wrote of the U.S., "A shocked and humble nation embarked on a bitter orgy of pedagogical soul-searching." Admiral Hyman Rickover wrote, condemning the school system as guilty of treason, in effect, as having undermined the security of the country. And the fact that that was taken very, very seriously is evidenced by the passing of the National Defense Education Act. And the source, it always struck me as interesting during my years as a graduate student at Berkeley, that so many dimensions of financial support for schools and programs came out of a U.S. law bearing the term defense in its title. And it really was quite some time before I put those things together and realized that it was precisely out of that concern for national security and the sense that the Russians are ahead of us, and the evidence of that was Sputnik in orbit. In 1958, the U.S. Congress passed that act. The Rockefeller Fund produced The Pursuit of Excellence, written by John Gardner, the president of the Carnegie Corporation. James Conant, the ex-president of Harvard University and ambassador to West Germany, published The American High School Today in 1959, and it immediately became a runaway bestseller. Schools paid more attention to gifted students and worked to raise academic standards. Standardized achievement scores rose steadily, and for the first time in the 20th century, foreign language enrollments actually grew. Not a tremendous amount, mind you. They went from 20% of U.S. high school students taking a foreign language to 24%. But given that as recently as 1959, only a third of young people in Canada graduated from high school, that kind of trend was quite a significant one. The early years of the 1960s saw tremendous public support for curriculum reform and curriculum development activities. Those were the heady days in the U.S. of Kennedy and Camelot, of a college being built a week, and in Canada, the spillover of that was in Victoria College becoming a university and Simon Fraser, the lighthouse on the hill, being created in 1965, that same era. Scholars everywhere regarded it as something worth doing to turn their attention to what they might say that would improve education in the elementary and high schools. It was almost inevitable that so much expertise and talent directed to the schools should find infinite potential for change and improvement. The teaching machine and programmed instruction, educational television, and the harnessing of the emerging new technology in general were expected to make the factory or egg crate schoolhouse obsolete. If I can adapt a quotation from Norman Goebel, the former executive director of the Canadian Teachers Federation, we have the image of the secondary school like a surfer poised on the brink of a wave rushing forward while university scholars paddle madly alongside, passing sustenance to the surfer. An image that makes one want to exclaim, "Oh, really?" Just when the momentum appeared unstoppable, a series of social issues emerged one after the other, and the schools of North America became the instrument expected to overcome the problems of the disadvantaged, became the context for the expression of the counterculture's challenge to traditional values, and the object of successive waves of romantic criticism, both from the left and the right. Even the book titles of those years will resonate, often discordantly for those of us who lived through them, close to educational institutions. A.S. Neil Summerhill extolled the virtues of permissiveness, a theme extended in Paul Goodman's Compulsory Miseducation. Death at an Early Age by Kozel and 36 Children by Cole were very personal accounts by two brilliant young men, graduates of Harvard, who felt that there was a mission to be carried out by working directly with children in the school system. Our Children Are Dying by Hentoff, The Way It's Supposed to Be, Herndon, Why Children Fail by John Holt, all chronicle the success of individual teachers, the writer, treating youngsters as human beings in spite of cruel, racist, bureaucratic institutions. It was only a small step beyond that to Ivan Illich's De-Schooling Society, a book which probably stimulated more coffee-clatch conversation than educational change. Throughout all this, most teachers, most of the time, went about their tasks with consistent commitment, if not spectacular results. Indeed, no matter how bleak the picture painted by the critics, just living and working with 36 children day in and day out demands establishing routines, maintaining order, conveying expectations, finding opportunities for humor and enjoyment, and even stimulating some learning on a fairly regular basis. Charles Silberman, a writer with an elegant and powerful style and the sponsorship of the Carnegie Corporation, produced Crisis in the Classroom in 1970. In so doing, he launched open education on a somewhat unsuspecting North American public. Others had discovered before him the British primary school, and some were beginning to preach the gospel according to Jean Piaget, but none had quite his gift of theological language and prophetic tone. To Silberman, the alienation of North American youth signaled a condition that, quotes, may well be a religious or spiritual crisis of a depth and magnitude that has no parallel since the Reformation. The restoration of meaning and purpose in our lives, in our society, and in our world was to be achieved by a transformation of the schools. It's interesting because, as you know, that was the age of the large rock concerts and the generation gap and the concern, and Silberman's words resonated in the public, received a very responsive, to a very responsive public. In British Columbia and across Canada, we felt the impact of the new religious zeal expressed in open education. One school after another leapt on the bandwagon, and the school architecture, if not the knowledge and commitment of teachers, reflected the new approach. Cynics at that time observed, of course, that it was cheaper to build schools without internal walls, and that might have accounted in part for the sudden conversion of a good many school boards. What was discovered, I think, was that the opening of the classroom in that way, without the understanding and commitment and participation of a closely planned team of teachers working together, was sheer disaster. And the kind of energy commitment that was entailed in surviving, let alone achieving in that context, was too much without the kind of infrastructure support and careful and thoughtful planning. At one point, British Columbia even retained as a senior ministry official, with open terms of reference, the founder of Philadelphia's Parkway School Without Walls, the epitome of open education since it used the entire city as its classroom. Here and there, a questioning voice was raised. One, for example, noted that good teachers in informal British classrooms provided more structure, not less. By the mid-70s, people were beginning to note that scholastic aptitude tests had been falling for a decade, and to question what it was that had gone wrong in the schools. Now, it's interesting to observe that it wasn't just the open education of that period, because Gene Chawl, the noted Harvard professor, did the major reading study sponsored by Carnegie, has pointed out that there's a very close correlation between the SAT scores of students graduating from high school and the vocabulary demands of the readers that they had in grade 1 12 years before. And that, in fact, by the very time we got through the open education period, the intellectual and vocabulary challenge of grade 1 readers had turned around tremendously. And we're beginning to see now that those SAT scores shifting upwards again. So it's very interesting. The foundation isn't what happens only in grade 10, 11, and 12. It's laid right back there in the elementary school, if not before. By the mid-70s, the Back to the Basics movement was in full swing. And those open classrooms, integrated programs, and other innovative approaches which survived did so chiefly as alternatives available for parents, teachers, and students who chose to participate in them. And I might say that their success is very different when it's a matter of choice and commitment and planning by those interested, willing, and committed to the concept. The past decade has seen great diversity, not only in public views of what the schools should be and do, but in the very clients of the schools themselves. As I mentioned earlier, as recently as 1959, only one-third of Canadian youth finished high school. Today, education is virtually universal, and at least 70% of Canadian youth graduate from high school on one program or another. One particular challenge to schools in extending the diversity of their clientele in both the United States and Canada has, as social and educational policy, been labeled mainstreaming. In the United States, through both federal and state legislation, and in Canada, in some provinces by provincial legislation, in this province by ministerial policy, our societies are attempting to foster in the least restrictive environment the maximum physical, social, and intellectual development of groups of people who have hitherto been segregated, not on the basis of race, but by virtue of handicaps, physical, emotional, or intellectual, often multiple. The hearing impaired, the visually impaired, the mentally retarded, and those with physical handicaps limiting their mobility have in the past been cared for at home or in specialized institutions where they were segregated by handicap. This very week, Both school authorities and advocacy groups are watching with interest and concern a court case taking place in Kelowna. And all I can say about that is that I profoundly hope we don't have too strong a decision in either direction. One of the things, because on the one hand, it would give encouragement to hard-nosed school boards who want to turn down access to people who differ in various ways. And on the other hand, it would give encouragement to advocacy groups and spawn a series of court cases that might bring us closer to the pattern in U.S. society, a trend which we could do without. Mainstreaming has obvious social benefits for all concerned, and if appropriate support can be brought to bear, it can enhance the learning environment for the handicapped without impairing it for others. I won't pause long this evening to comment on curricular diversity. Suffice it to say that where once a core curriculum might well have been almost the entire slate of courses offered, today's comprehensive urban secondary school will offer an impressive cafeteria of 100 or more courses. As a political priority, consumer education was incorporated very rapidly and effectively in the curriculum of BC's high schools. And though some might cringe at the lack of academic challenge in some subjects, I must say I'm very grateful that I learned to type in high school. In one sense, the most useful instruction I received. Today it might be called keyboarding for word processing and computer applications. Curricular diversity's blessings are not unmixed, however, when the complexity of the timetable in some schools results in as many as 60% of British Columbia's secondary school teachers teaching in subjects for which they have little or no formal academic preparation. Not that they are unprepared to teach. All of BC's secondary school teachers, and we have as good an academic preparation by the faculties of arts and science in every case for the teachers in BC's high schools. It isn't a question of whether they are prepared adequately for teaching a particular subject, but 60% of them end up teaching in subjects for which they have little or no formal academic preparation. Returning to Vancouver, the district in which we find ourselves, I want to pay particular attention to cultural and linguistic variety. This is a graph presenting the shift in Vancouver's elementary school enrollment from 1974 through 1982. And you'll notice, of course, that the elementary school enrollment was dropping quite drastically. It dropped during that period 9,000 students. At the same time, the population of students who had English as a second language rose somewhat. And the population of those among them who required some assistance, English as a second language student who required special assistance, was rising very much more steeply. Now let me show you the same trend in the secondary school. Again, you see the total population of the secondary school in fairly sharp decline during that 8-year period, while the population of ESL students was going like this, and the population of ESL students requiring some particular assistance also increasing fairly substantially. To put some figures to that, while the population in Vancouver's schools over that 8-year period dropped by 14,000 students, that masked the fact that the population of ESL students had grown by between 5,000 and 6,000 students, and the population of non-ESL students, that is those who had English as a first language, had dropped by 20,000. So that by 1974, well over 24,000 students in Vancouver's school system, out of a total of 52,000, had English as a second language. That is 46.5% of the population in Vancouver's elementary and secondary schools. Now, when I present those figures, and those, by the way, are taken from a study by Latour in the Vancouver school system, a study that was repeated at these intervals, 1974, 77, 80, and 82. When I mention those facts, people are often startled because they do not realize what a dramatic approximation of the United Nations we have in Vancouver. There are students in Vancouver schools who have 85 different languages as their first language. All of these languages have 1% or more of the student body who have that language, own that language as their first language. Now, you'll notice here that the top one, the number couldn't be contained on the bar graph of this width, and so it's broken. But well over 4,000 students have Cantonese as their first language. Other small Chinese languages spoken by small groups, 1,120. And then if we come down to this, Mandarin, another 508. So that fully a third of the students for whom English is a second language come from a Chinese language background. I should hasten to add, and you'll notice the others, they're a very interesting range of languages. I should hasten to add that to say a student had English as a second language is not to suggest for a minute that the student did not have substantial facility in English. And the method, I particularly want to comment on the methodology of that study, because the question asked was which students had English as a language learned after another language or concurrently with another language. So a good many of those students came from bilingual homes. And in fact, two-thirds of them, of the 24,000 ESL students in Vancouver, fully two-thirds compared favorably with their age peers who had English as a first language in terms of their English facility. I really want to stress that. The fact that someone has English as a second language is by no means an indication that their English will be less adequate than that of the person who has English as a first language. And many of those students are indeed people whose lives are enriched in many ways by facility and great fluency, both in English and in one or more other languages. Another form of diversity, less positive in its impact on the lives of Vancouver children and teachers, is the result of a vast increase in almost any measure of social dislocation we choose to examine. I have a colleague who claims we should develop a psychosocial price index to parallel the consumer price index, and to serve as a measure of the disruptive and self-destructive tendencies in our society. I won't cite figures on marriage breakdowns, illegitimate births, or abortions, but I will note that 1 in 10 women married or living common law is the victim of physical assault each year. Alcoholism is an increasingly serious problem. Many young people start drinking as young as 12, 60% by their mid-teens, and 90% drink alcohol regularly in their 20s. 10 years ago, Canadians passed the United States in consumption of alcohol per capita, and now we have the dubious distinction of falling behind only the French and West Germans among all Western nations. The percentage of alcoholics in the population has doubled in the past 2 decades. A more direct measure of self-destruction is the suicide rate. While that has doubled in the past 30 years for the population in general, it has multiplied 7 times over for the 15 to 19 age group, and now stands at 12.7 per 100,000. To get a snapshot of what this increased diversity means in the life of a Vancouver school, I borrowed an excerpt from a recent talk by Dr. Lapini, superintendent of schools. In addressing a service club in Vancouver, Dr. Lapini said, "Each of you as business people has your clients and you take an interest in them and their needs. Now let me tell you about the clients of the Vancouver school system. These elementary schools, he was going to speak of two, while not typical of all elementary schools in Vancouver, are characteristic of many Vancouver schools. In other words, I can assure you that if you randomly selected any one school in our district, you would find all, or at least the majority of characteristics outlined in the following examples. School A. School A is one of our large elementary schools with 750 students. 80% of these students have a first language other than English. 20% of them come from a home with only one parent present. School teachers and administrators are involved in one or two cases a week of child abuse, sexual abuse, or child neglect. They maintain a strong liaison with city social planning, the Ministry of Human Resources, the police, and other social agencies. The incidence of family violence and disruption is high, and the teachers and principal deal with Ministry of Human Resources, social workers, and child care workers on a daily basis. The school has a child care counselor on staff, funded by the Ministry of Human Resources, and the teachers tell us that they couldn't manage without her. Five different main language groups exist in the school community. The school has nine families where one parent has been ordered by the courts to stay away from his or her children. The school has a dedicated staff who are providing, in the face of all this, an excellent program for their children. School B. School B is one of our smaller elementary schools with 250 students. 55% of the children are from a home with only one family present. 12% come from blended families, the current word for families where the original parents no longer live together and children from two families have come together. About nine children attend the school from the Monroe House for Battered Women. 28% of the students have English as a second language. The school averages 12 reported cases of sexual and physical abuse per year. The school accommodates 17 children with neurological handicaps, and they're integrated into regular classrooms as often as possible. The school provides space for a daycare facility in the basement, which opens at 7 in the morning and closes at 6 in the evening. As was the case with the previous school, the staff are dedicated and well qualified. They, too, are providing an excellent program. It's important to remember that the students in these schools come to us from the society in which you and I live, a society which has undergone fundamental changes during the past 10 or 15 years. Our responsibility is to accept these children and, while under our care, provide for them the best education possible. Those are the words of Dr. Dante Lepini, Vancouver School Superintendent. Let me now share with you just some small aspects, partial glimpses of what I think of what I would present as one vision of what could be. I have observed that throughout our history, at least until the last quarter century, Canadians shared a moral consensus about the mission of the school. That consensus saw intellectual development as central, but intellectual development constrained by a moral purpose. However, consensus about the manifest functions of the schools does not limit the functions actually served. John Porter and others, many of them less and many more radical than he, have characterized Canadian society as a vertical mosaic in which our social institutions, schools in particular, sort the young very effectively to ensure that their place in society approximates that of their parents. These scholars demonstrate 50 observation of an invariant sequence in cross-cultural relations. Remember, Park suggested that the sequence was always this: contact, competition, accommodation, and assimilation. Bolaria, for example, notes the inadequacy of the oft-repeated immigrant analogy, in which we assume the social mobility of recently arrived visible minority group members will approximate that of earlier majority group immigrants. The story goes essentially like this. We say, well, look at the Irish, they made it, didn't they? Look at the Scots, they made it, didn't they? And we look at people as they've moved up the mosaic, and we say, and now these recent immigrant groups are just going to take that bit of time that's required, that generation or so, for acculturation, and they'll move up in just the same way. Bolaria dismisses the immigrant analogy as a contemporary version of the myth of progress and opportunity, a sort of modern-day G.A. Henty novel. Equality of opportunity is assumed, and racial inequality is attributed to different degrees of assimilation, or inadequate assimilation into the value system of the host society, when indeed it may be a product not of the behavior of the minority group member, but of the very structure of the society. Far too often, the impact of society upon the individual conveys the sense of a sharp divergence between rhetoric and reality, as if the left hand of actual practice had no idea what the right hand of public policy were doing. To give one brief illustration, some years ago, We in British Columbia were the fortunate recipients of a very talented and interesting group of refugees from East Africa during the period of Idi Amin's Reign of Terror. And I recall, as dean then of the Faculty of Education at Simon Fraser, meeting a number of Ugandan refugees and saying to them, a number of whom happened to be highly skilled and well-educated teachers, who, however, I felt needed some transition if they were going to serve in that kind of professional role in a society which is somewhat different from that in which they were experienced. And recognizing the amount of political capital that Canada had gained on the international scene by supposedly welcoming these refugees with open arms, I said, well, surely the government is going to support you while you take a reorientation program. And in fact, we began to plan at Simon Fraser how we could establish a reorientation program that could give people a gradual assimilation into the school and an opportunity for taking up the profession that they had left in East Africa. Well, imagine my surprise when I discovered that the federal government was quite prepared to support them if they would take a secretarial training course or if they would take a heavy-duty mechanics course. But if they were going to do something that was going to prepare them to be reabsorbed in the profession for which they were trained, they were going to be cut off cold. And I thought, well, surely this is misunderstanding. And I phoned the Secretary of State's office, and I phoned Canada Employment and Immigration, and sure enough, everywhere I turned, I got the same kind of answer. Well, it's just a small example of the way in which the rhetoric and the way and the actual reality strike people very differently. We eventually made the round of the churches of Vancouver and various other groups to get the kind of support we needed to sustain those people who underwent that reorientation. And a number of them are now teaching in British Columbia very successfully. For a more immediate example, consider the potential impact of current restraint policies on educational practice in Vancouver. Some years ago, the provincial government recognized the need, quotes, to better facilitate the coordination of services of the social service ministries as they deal with the needs of children. And therefore, it founded local interministerial committees with representation from the ministries of human resources, health, education, and the attorney general. One of the outcomes was to identify the school as the appropriate neighborhood institution from which to deliver some social services to children and parents of the community the school also served. The same principle underlies the delivery of community health services, which has been focused on the schools for generations. Well, it was felt particularly important to do this in communities where as many as 25% of the children and youth were considered to be at risk. Now I quote from a recent, as recent as this week, a school board brief to the Minister of Human Resources. The provision of social services by social workers and child care counselors is efficient and effective because it responds to the needs of children, which are most readily identified by professionals who are in day-to-day contact with a child. Over the past 10 years, the policies of mainstreaming children with special emotional, physical, health, and/or social needs within their home community has meant that each agency or institution serving the needs of these children must provide its component of the required services in order that each child may be successful in his or her home environment and benefit from the appropriate community resources and institutions. They go on to note that they're alarmed to learn that the child care workers who have been working in 15 elementary schools in Vancouver were to be withdrawn or cut in the current circumstances. And go on to say, we were alarmed to learn that it costs approximately $10,000 per year to keep a child in a day treatment resource, $38,000 per year to keep a child in a residential treatment resource like Children's Foundation, and $43,000 for children in an intensive child care resource. We know other ministries also incur extremely high costs in providing for legal services, court expenses, probation, and incarceration. The community also has higher policing costs as a result of the investigation of shoplifting, vandalism, and breaking and entering.
that often are the avenues of expression for emotionally and behaviorally disturbed youth. In economic terms alone, it makes sense to provide for programs that allow children to function effectively in their own homes and schools. I come now to the potential for multicultural education in a city with Vancouver's cultural and linguistic diversity. As articulated in 1971, Canada's official policy of multiculturalism comprised four commitments. First, resources permitting, the government will seek to assist all Canadian cultural groups that have demonstrated a desire and effort to continue to develop a capacity to grow and contribute to Canada, and a clear need for assistance, the small and weak groups no less than the strong and highly organized. Second, the government will assist members of all cultural groups to overcome cultural barriers to full participation in Canadian society. Third, the government will promote creative encounters and interchange among all Canadian cultural groups in the interests of national unity. Fourth, the government will continue to assist immigrants to acquire at least one of Canada's official languages in order to become full participants in Canadian society. A vast amount has been written about multicultural education, and I particularly appreciate the work of my colleague, Professor Gerald Coombs, in bringing conceptual order out of a literature which on occasion exhibits more enthusiasm than logic or evidence. In his paper, Multicultural Education and Social Justice, Coombs identifies three kinds of multicultural education. Procedural, which focuses on the characteristics of the processes of schooling. Social, which focuses on preparing students for responsible citizenship in a certain type of society, and curricular, which focuses on the content. Let me speak briefly to the first two. Procedural multicultural education is that arises out of a concern for adjusting schooling to cultural differences. For example, permitting study in native languages, providing materials which draw on the experiences and symbols of an ethnic group, setting out to avoid damaging self-respect by intentionally or unintentionally denigrating cultural background, providing culturally relevant models for success. It arises in large part as a reaction to practices thought to be effective for dominant or mainstream groups, but ineffective for students from minority groups. Therefore, conditions which differentiate the success of groups which enter the schools. The purpose, then, of multicultural education in this form is to make educational procedures more consistent with the moral requirement of respecting persons and providing equal educational opportunity. If we assume that access to the resources and rewards of society are linked to educational attainments, then it's only just that we strenuously avoid placing students from cultural minorities at a disadvantage in competing for educational achievements. Let me comment on social multicultural education. Coombs makes the point that, one, because our society is culturally diverse, we're concerned with social multicultural education. Well, that makes a lot of sense. If it were homogeneous, we wouldn't have that challenge. Secondly, it's because we want to eradicate social injustice that we need a concept of cultural pluralism. It's concern for social justice. Now, that's not new, but historically we've assumed that full participation in society's institutions will require assimilation to the norms of the dominant group or the mainstream group. What is newly emerging is the notion that it is unjust to require some but not all to change their values in order to achieve equal success in educational and economic terms. To achieve equal access, I should say. Obviously, people are not going to achieve equal success. Coombs rightly, I think, sees the promotion of cultural pluralism as arising fundamentally out of a concern for social justice rather than an interest in diversity as an end in itself. He then argues that to assure equal opportunities, institutions in a pluralistic society must be culturally sensitive as opposed to culturally neutral. In sum, then, what Combs suggests is that multicultural education is primarily and fundamentally a moral concern. It's a moral education which entails the concept of the person as the locus of rights and responsibilities, and the understanding that cultural differences are irrelevant and that irrelevant to personhood, and that the principle of justice applies to all persons. It's perhaps also a political education in that a clear concept of justice is of little purpose if people don't have access to the levers of power to bring about a just society. And finally, a word about the opportunities inherent in our linguistic diversity. Vancouver is extremely fortunate in having a tremendous number of voluntary ethnic and multi-ethnic organizations committed to enhancing liaison between the community and the school. Success, for example, the United Chinese Community Enrichment Services Society, MOSAIC, a nice graphic acronym, the Multilingual Orientation Services Association for Immigrant Communities. Vancouver is also to be lauded, I think, for the development of district policies on racism and multiculturalism, because these have been instruments for consciousness raising and also guides to practice. A recent event at Seymour Elementary School is a fitting symbol, I think, of multicultural activities and achievements. The children there very recently presented a community event, one of the few in the school's history, to which families and community members were invited. The sailing of the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria was presented, and it seems to me most interesting that an event which involved a Genoese captain trained in Portugal, sponsored by a Spanish queen, and landing in the New World, was presented to an admiring audience fully in English and Chinese. On January 14th of this year, the Heritage Language Association of British Columbia, with the help of the Vancouver School Board, launched a program providing under one roof instruction in Italian, Mandarin, Chinese, Gujarati, Arabic, and Filipino. And Charles Tupper School every Saturday morning now is filled with something like 800 youngsters studying heritage languages, while the hundreds of parents who have brought them have the opportunity of participating in the board's career courses in the typing, home ec, and industrial education shops of the same school. Now, that's the product largely of volunteer community groups coordinated by themselves with facilities supplied at cost by the Vancouver School District, subsidized by the Secretary of State through its cultural enrichment program, and charging very modest tuition to the children involved. I think heritage language programs are very promising, and they do a tremendous amount potentially to enhance the experience of the individuals who participate in them. But I would like to see our linguistic competence given much higher priority, not just for those who are attempting to preserve a heritage culture, but for mainstream society too. It was Keith Spicer, the former commissioner of official languages, who said that Canadians are the only people he knows who regard learning another language as a pain in the neck rather than as an opportunity. I've been heartened recently to see the increasing popularity of French immersion programs. And while it's true that they don't deliver at grade 12 somebody with quite the fluency of Pierre Trudeau, they nevertheless deliver people who can get along very comfortably in both French and English, and they do so without inhibiting the achievement in the regular academic subjects. A somewhat cynical principal remarked to me the other day that he thought French immersion had taken over from home movies and Suzuki violin, as what you do when you have guests over for dinner, and after dinner you trot the kids out, say a few words in French, and send them off to bed. I trust there's more to it than that. But it seems to me that as we live in Vancouver, poised on the Pacific Rim, with 85 languages represented in our population and in our school population, as we talk about the Pacific Rim, as we talk about relating to the European economic community, the potential for using the resource in our midst for systematic, intellectual, hardworking language study and study of other cultures is something which ought to and must indeed be given a high priority in our schools. Mary Ashworth, who last year won the TESOL World Award for her work in English as a second language, has often said, "He who has two languages and two cultures has two ways of looking at the world, and he can move beyond the tunnel vision of many Anglophone Canadians." We have a United Nations in our midst. And I would like to suggest in closing this evening that if we are to overcome Babel as confusion of tongues, we're going to do it not by returning to a single language, but by finding the means to connect across cultures and across languages if we're to regain a consensus on the purposes of schooling. What better basis than a commitment to the maximum intellectual development in a context and form that assures equality of opportunity? And couldn't we add, if we're looking for a moral purpose of schooling, couldn't we add to that a commitment to developing the skills and understanding requisite to promoting intercultural and international communication and cooperation? Thank you.
Dean Birch is willing to answer questions, so may we have some now if you have them.
Yes. It would seem the federal government, in drafting the Constitution of Canada, opted for the procedural rather than the moral justification of multiculturalism. For minorities are assisted to maintain linguistic and cultural diversity, but are not guaranteed the right to an education, to acquire the official language, to permit access to full participation in Canadian life.
Can you repeat that?
The observation, I will characterize it rather than a question, was that it would seem the government has opted for a procedural rather than a moral commitment to multiculturalism, since it makes provision for preserving heritage languages but does little to enhance the opportunity of learning one of the official languages. Was that the observation? Let me make a comment on that. I won't try to answer it since it's not a question. But a comment would be this. I have received an amazing number of telephone calls from the press during the past week. And I owe that to the Vancouver Institute. Most of them have attempted to get me to respond to one variant or another of the question, is it the federal government's responsibility? Is it the provincial government's responsibility? Is it the school district's responsibility? And my observation would be that on these questions, we all have a moral responsibility. And that far too often in Canada, we get ourselves into the debate of, is it the federal or provincial, to the detriment of the clients that we're actually trying to work with. We prevent ourselves, in doing that, we prevent ourselves from asking the important questions, like what are the essentials of the education we provide the young people in elementary and secondary school? We get ourselves diverted from asking the important question of, what is an appropriate scale of resources that a society ought to commit to the education of our young? Because we're so diverted into asking whose responsibility it is. I've heard people say that because immigration in Canada is a federal responsibility, So ESL and French as a second language and so on should be a federal responsibility. Well, first of all, immigration is a shared federal-provincial responsibility in the Constitution, although most provinces haven't chosen to exercise their share in that, with the exception of Quebec. Secondly, it seems to me that when a province accepts a substantial proportion of immigrants, that province is receiving a very rich resource. And we ought to accept ourselves the responsibility for the education of that rich resource, and we ought in turn to use it as a resource for the education of other citizens. Yes?
Do you feel that we have responsibility for teaching 85 languages at the expense of having a common language that everyone can enjoy?
The question was, would I feel that we ought to teach 85 languages at the expense of having a common language which everyone can use and enjoy? And I think the answer that I would give is no, I wouldn't carry it that far. But we're a long way from that, Mrs. Lev. We, at the moment, in British Columbia, in our schools, German has almost disappeared, Spanish has almost disappeared, Russian has almost disappeared. We have a significant proportion of the students studying French as a second language. In Steveston, we have Japanese, and in Grand Forks, we have Russian. And the heritage language programs are outside the school curriculum. They're provided largely by volunteer community groups in those minority languages. I frankly believe that language is a first-rate subject for systematic, rigorous intellectual study in the school. And while I don't think we're about to bring in 85 languages, I really think we have to start somewhere. And I would really like to see a school that specialized in teaching Chinese language and culture, bringing an understanding of Chinese concepts of beauty, of the culture and background and history and achievements of the Chinese, as equally legitimate to many of the other subjects we teach and enjoy. I believe that we have done a great deal in enhancing the quality of the curriculum in science and technology dimension, and we haven't done nearly enough in the humanities and culture.
Yes. The United States have been paid if all those Europeans can come in and talk their own language. Was it the fact that when they came to the United States they had to go to school and they had to talk English and made it possible to create that country?
Yes, the question, let me repeat it, was could the United States have been created if everybody came in and spoke their own language rather than coming in and learning a common language which contributed to the creation of a great nation? And I think the answer is obvious. It's a rhetorical question, and I would agree with you that the learning of a common language is essential. I would suggest to you, however, that if you look at the United States today, you'll see a very interesting phenomenon developing. And I would be willing to venture that the United States will be much more bilingual 20 or 30 years from now than it is today, and that there will in fact be pockets and groups of people who speak Spanish only and do so and at a high level. Now, when you look at that, there are several phenomena involved. One of them is a very interesting distinction that a sociologist at the University of California has made, that he has divided ethnic groups into what he calls autonomous ethnic groups, and this would be groups like the Amish, for example, or the Mormons as a cultural group, and immigrant groups, and thirdly, what he calls caste-like groups. And one of the interesting phenomena in U.S. society is that there are groups of people who are there in the United States as members of a predominantly English-speaking country, not by their choice. And that includes both the large black population, which doesn't today maintain heritage languages, and it includes conquered Spanish-speaking people in areas like Puerto Rico and in the South and Southwest, particularly, whose mobility in society has been very limited. And bilingual education there is gaining tremendous headway, and I suspect will be accelerating over the next while. Yeah.
Yes. I've been listening to you talk considerable amount of interest. There's one area you don't appear to have covered, sir.
Many.
And that is to give the average child some indication of what lies in store for him beyond school.
Yes.
I've had the fortune to be brought up in an English system as well as the Swiss one. And the Swiss system provides for one lecture a week. We have about 40 weeks of schooling, which describes the world outside. For example, you learn something about the service industries, teaching, accountancy, hotels, tourism, or you can learn something about industry.
Yes.
What it's like to be in a foundry, preparing a newspaper, and so forth. And it seems to me that rather than relying on the council, who probably knows nothing about accountancy, it would be a far better system for the students to be exposed at least once a week, dispassionately by the homeroom teacher, to a prepared slide presentation of what he thinks.
Did you hear the observation? It was essentially this, that there is at least one subject I didn't touch on, and I will confess to being guilty on that. And the particular one, and this gentleman observed that in the Swiss educational system which he had experienced, the schools gave more systematic attention to preparing students for an understanding of what lay out there in the real world beyond schooling. And the question was, could we do a better job of bringing into the schools an understanding of service industries, professions, manufacturing industries, and so on, by prepared, whether slide tape presentations or other things, some exposure to what life in the real world is like. And several observations about it. When, obviously, in industrial societies, schools get quite separated from real life. If you will pardon me an anecdote, some years ago I watched a small group of children playing house, and they assigned the roles, and there was daddy, and there was a little boy, and a little girl, and mummy, and the one nobody wanted was daddy. Nobody wanted that role. And finally Dougie was told, "You're the daddy." And the rest, I saw why in a few minutes, they didn't want that role, because the others went about their business in the corner of the basement that was house, very actively, knowing exactly what was expected of them, interacting and all the rest of it, while poor Dougie got his lunch bucket, got on his tricycle, and pedaled off to the other side of the basement. Now, you know, Dougie sat and waited, and then he pedaled back. And they said to him, "We're not ready for you yet." So, yeah. And it illustrated to me very graphically just how, when we, you know, in a complex society where the induction into adult roles doesn't take place as it does on the farm or for the hunter and gatherer directly by the youngster approximating the adult behavior, we end up with specialized formal institutions. And yes, you're right. There are many things that we could do better to bring down, to bring about connections between the schools and the community. I really think it's too long a story, though, to speculate on all the things we might do.
Question here first.
You identified the multicultural language thing as a moral question. Now, are you confident that in these kinds of moral issues, the kind of society we want to build, those kind of issues are weighed against economic training, skills development type issues, that the money is going to go as much to those kind of values as to those other more economically oriented concerns?
I think you heard that question, didn't you?
No?
No? Well, let me repeat it again then. I identified the multicultural and linguistic issues as moral issues. And the question was, am I confident in a time of scarce resources that moral questions will have as much leverage as economic ones like skill training and so on? Well, I think the answer is no, I'm not confident. But I believe that if we have a clear moral vision and purpose, and what I'm calling for essentially is a new consensus about a moral goal for schooling, right? What I've suggested is that we had a consensus for a long time, that that's fragmented, and we need to bring it again into focus. And what I am confident of is that the clearer our vision, the more likely we are to achieve it. Yeah. Yes. Question. The comment from Mrs. Nimitz was, in talking recently with someone who lived in a wealthy New York suburb and asking about the quality of education, the comment was that the educational experience of young people there was greatly enriched by the fact that many members of the professional community gave their time voluntarily for lectures and presentations and participation in the school. And the tag to that was, couldn't we consider that kind of contribution, especially in a time of restraint? Well, first of all, I think that the participation of volunteers in the Vancouver Public Schools is astronomical. Schools are not isolated from the community to nearly the extent that we might think. I don't have the figures, but I have, in fact, recently asked for them and examined them. But yes, we could do very much more. One of the techniques that has been used in a number of American cities recently is the twinning of large corporations with a school system or a particular school. And that has been a very interesting one, because what it does is bring about a focus of commitment to the quality of education in that school. And while we have to be, I think there's a lesson to be learned. Remember, I mentioned to you that in the 1960s, the whole letting loose of a tremendous amount of interest and commitment and enthusiasm on the schools did not, in fact, in all cases, enhance the quality of what happened in them. But nevertheless, I think there is a great deal of room for bringing in that kind of community expertise and generating that kind of commitment.
I think we have two more questions.
Oh.
You mentioned in your talk that in a particular school, I may be a little wrong with my percentages. 55% of the students came out of one-parent families.
Yes.
And it was a 250-student school, and the other one had 20%. And you mentioned again single-parent families. Why? Is there indeed a different achievement level for children who come out of that situation?
That, I think, is a very good question. And frankly, it represents a real dilemma to me. I recognize that there are tremendously shifting norms, and one of the increasing areas of diversity is in family patterns. I have in the past been involved in social studies materials for schools. And our president's wife, Mrs. Peterson, has been writing school materials for the primary grades. Now, one of the dilemmas faced by Mrs. Peterson as an author and by her publisher is, if you have a group of four or five stories about the family for a grade one class, do you present one nuclear family, one extended family, one single parent family, one family of mixed ethnic group, and so on, and then suddenly there's leased upon you the outrage of those who have a particular ideal. And your question was a perfectly legitimate one. I would not begin to suggest that there is a clear differentiation in the achievement of children from two-parent families and one-parent families. In fact, I would suggest that in a fair number of instances, the very fact that there is a single parent taking that responsibility means that the quality of that person's commitment to time and energy spent on the children may indeed be higher than it would be otherwise. So you're quite proper in raising that as a concern. I
saw three hands more go up just now. If there are short questions, I'll try and take those three. But we mustn't impose too long.
Is the present debate for higher education funding been pointed out that the participation rate in British Columbia is lower on an average than it is elsewhere in Canada? And that, of course, is a disappointing state of affairs. But let's turn this around for a minute and ask, in the public schools as such, is there some force, some motivation, some practice that is perhaps contributing, on the other hand, to this lower participation?
I think that's a very good question, and I really do not have the answers. I wish I did. Oh, I'll repeat the question, yes. Dr. Dirks asked, we observed that we've been told that the participation rate in post-secondary education is in British Columbia is among the lowest in Canada. And he said, he asked, is there some factor in the elementary and secondary schools that may have some bearing on it? That is it not only the pull of the university that may be lacking, or the university and colleges and technical institute, but also the push of the secondary schools, as it were? And I wish I could answer that. In fact, I can't. There are a large number of secondary school graduates in British Columbia who are qualified, and indeed equally qualified with those who do attend university and college and other forms of post-secondary education, who choose not to. I suspect, but it's a bit dangerous to be speculating, I suspect that family tradition and expectation is a very, very significant element in that.
Up in several cultures, languages, and all that. And I have found, I just like to comment on this, I have found that language, the difficulty that English-speaking, English-first language persons have difficulty with other languages because they somehow have a mental block in believing that another language is the other side of a dictionary. They don't see that another language is another way of thinking. And the first thing we have to do is to want to understand the thinking of another person, whether it is English, Chinese, or anything else. The rest will take care of itself. So that two people understand each other, they can still go on talking their own language, but they won't be understanding the other person. I'd like to comment.
I'm not at all sure I can repeat that. It was expressed so elegantly that I can't compete. If I understood it, the observation was that a large number of people who speak English as a first language fall into the trap of thinking of English as really just the kind of thing that you might get from of learning another language as just the kind of thing you might get from a phrase book, that if you only pick up the vocabulary and the equivalents, that somehow you've got it. Whereas the learning of another language is really another way of thinking. And that, to the gentleman who himself is multilingual, the observation is that the trick in learning another language is to get inside the thought process of the other person, and then everything follows very nicely from that. And indeed, and not only that, you needn't even completely learn the language, but you can understand the person speaking his language and he understand you speaking yours. All I can do is agree.
Thank you. I'll now call on Dr. Robert Smith, the academic vice president at UBC, to express our thanks.
Well, thank you, Dr. Bourne, and thank you, Dean Birch, for an authoritative, spirited, and lively presentation on a topic that I think there are many, on which there are many points of view, many very firmly held. I think the context you have given us in which to perhaps organize our thoughts, our convictions, our prejudices, and so on in this general area, the consensus, diversity, and then some of the visions of multiculturalism is an extremely useful and a revealing context. And I think we're indeed very grateful to you tonight for sharing your perspective on this very complex topic with us. Thank you.